Happy Halloween! Welcome to another episode of Bloodhouse, the show where we talk about art house horror movies. I'm your host, Joshua Conkle.
And I am your manically addicted and infested co-host, is Drusilla Adeline. And it's Hollow-fucking-ween, or as Halloween. Close to Halloween as it is wherever you are listening to this episode, because time is not a linear space and people listen to podcasts whenever. But this is releasing around Halloween, and so we can hang jack-o'-lanterns and jack-o'-melons and do silly voices as long as
all
we want,
that.
And you can't sue us for it.
And it's an excuse to do something special, which we love to do. But first, how are you, Drew? What's going on?
I'm good now. I had a very weird week. I had a weird panic attack a few nights ago over... Was this boils down to nothing, but I was having what I thought was health issues.
Okay.
Which is a great way to start any sentence, especially with your doctor. Because I thought like a week or so ago, my tongue felt weird and I was having taste issues. And so I was like, I'll just hydrate and that'll go away. And it didn't. Okay. And it was like a week. And I was like, do I have COVID? What the fuck is this? And then I looked at my tongue in the mirror and it looked weird and it looked lumpy and it discolored. And I thought that like I was in a Cronenberg movie for a minute or something like that. It looked like Elmer from Brain Damage. And I was like, the fuck is going on? And so I like... panicked, and I was like, I've got oral cancer and I'm gonna lose my tongue and they're gonna have to cut my tongue out and oh my fucking god. And okay. I was like up all night freaking out, and I freaked my partner out, and I like got no sleep. And the first thing next morning I called my doctor's office and they're like, that sounds important, that sounds bad, oh my god, we're going to have you in immediately. And I was like, they sound scared about this, so that's going to make me more scared about this. That's great. And so I go to see my doctor, and she looked at my tongue, and she was like, yeah, just lay off, like, acidic and spicy foods. And I was like, oh. You mean my entire diet? She was like, yeah. it's just a chemical reaction from entirely too much like salts and acids. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like my diet.
Better safe than sorry, I guess.
I mean, I feel better now.
Yeah.
Just a big old dummy. So that was my big fright for Halloween. I played it on myself.
There's this is what I thought you were going to say. There's like a very common experience that people have where they think that they're having a heart attack, so they go to the hospital, and it turns out they're having a panic attack because the symptoms are actually really similar. Your heart is in pain as if you have heartburn. Maybe your left arm hurts or is throbbing, which is a symptom of both the heart attack.
Also, like, the more you think you're having a heart attack, if you know certain symptoms, your brain will be like, symptoms like this? And it'll start, like, manifesting.
Totally.
When I saw Inland Empire in theaters, like, a year or so ago, I got entirely too high and started convincing myself that I was having a heart attack in the theater. So I had a panic attack thinking I was having a heart attack while watching a Lynch movie. Stoned out of my mind. I don't recommend it.
That's what I did when I went and saw, when Midsommar came out, I went and saw it on edibles, and I was like, this was a mistake.
That's a bad idea. You're gonna have a bad time. Speaking of Midsommar, though, and of Halloween, I did do a big Halloween celebration. I went to a big pumpkin patch, like 40 minutes outside of the city.
I went to the same one. Go on, now.
Over in Moore Park?
Yes.
Oh my god.
I did the same thing with Michael Kennedy and a bunch of friends.
That's so cute. I went with my partner and my best friend and her boyfriend, and like we went as the whole little crew. It was so goddamn
adorable.
Cute and fun. I think there's still a temporary tattoo slightly on my arm. It was so fun. I love it's the Underwood Family Farms over in Moore Park. I'd been before. It's really, really delightful. It's like a 40-minute drive outside of Los Angeles, and like highly, highly, it's the best way to like just kind of breathe in fall in the best way. It feels so much like my childhood in Indiana, because it's like hay bales and like scarecrows, and it's so precious. I love it so much, and we got so many jams and so many pumpkins and so many preserves.
I love anything that feels like a county fair. You know,
yes,
like, I want to be on a Gravitron and for Def Leppard to be blasting.
If you're selling me an elephant ear, I want to smell goat shit from like 2 feet away. Like that is 100%. The vibe I'm going for.
Yeah,
but it was so much fun. It was so much cute. It was great. We took a lot of photos and we had a great time. It felt very Season of the Witch. It felt very Wicker Man. We were truly ringing in the harvest. I believe a cop was burned alive, like not far away. It was great. It was a good time.
Wait a minute. This is not the same pumpkin event I went to. I went to one in Whittier, which is also 40 minutes outside of the
That's
city.
On the south side. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's north. Also one at Descanso Gardens in Pasadena that I mean to go to. I am not as busy as I have been in October's past, which is good because usually I get so exhausted. Same. I'm still exhausted,
this is
but
the busy I've, month for
I've been saying
us.
No to a lot of stuff. And it's really nice.
You're taking Nancy Reagan's suggestion.
Exactly.
And just say no on Halloween
to invitations. but I have been watching movies at home. I did just rewatch my favorite Evil Dead movie, hot take, which is Army of Darkness.
Okay. So speaking of that being a hot take, we were out to dinner or like something like after that big pumpkin patch event. And like we were having a conversation about movies and someone pulled up their letterbox and was like, hey, look, Josh just watched Army of Darkness. And we were like, oh, that's so cute. And then someone at the table was like, yeah, he only gave it 3.5 stars. And every single person at the table was like, like roasting you alive for only giving Army of Darkness 3.5 stars.
It's my favorite Evil Dead movie. I think 3.5
stars
is good.
So it put it higher than 3.5 stars.
To me, 3.5 stars means literally this, really good. To me, 2 stars is I didn't really like it. 3 stars is I liked it. 3.5 stars is I really liked it. 4 stars is I love it. 5 stars is it's perfect.
Yeah.
No notes. Maybe I should give it 4 stars. I should give it 4 stars. Listen, this is not a science. Who's at this table, by the way? I want to know. Name names. I'm going to
scathing bitches. Halloween bitches with vendettas. Bruce Campbell's extended family.
I feel like Army of Darkness is not liked that much. That's my sense. And to me, it's so special because I love D&D and horror movies, and it gives me both. But I did feel like this time, like, why is this not scored by heavy metal songs? That would make it so much better.
Truly. It's so funny because, like, at the exact same time, you were getting John Carpenter scoring all of his movies with heavy metal songs, like, In the Mouth of Madness and They Live, and it feels really discordant in those, and you're just like, just flip-flop, and this will be great.
If you could take some of the songs or even just the sounds of Return of the Living Dead and put it on top of Army of Darkness, like, mwah, perfect.
Party time by 45 Grave inside of Army of Darkness. Let's fucking go.
During those big battle scenes with the undead. Come on, like, give us some Iron Maiden or some Judas Priest or whatever.
It might be time for me to make my fan edit of Army of Darkness.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, man, I would love to rescore this with like old butt rock songs.
Hell yeah, put some fucking like Poison in there. Honestly, an all Motley Crue scored Army of Darkness would be great, because that's what Demons is. Is essentially an Evil Dead movie scored by Motley Crue.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
I feel really chastised. I am telling the listeners now, as soon as this is over, I'm gonna go raise that score to 4 stars. It's true. It is true. It should be 4 stars.
Listeners, please take this as a lesson that bullying works. and that the Evil Dead franchise is the only perfect franchise with no misses, including a TV show. Like,
I love Evil Dead.
It's so fucking good. I
want to know who is at that table, though.
I can't say that on mic. People will get death threats.
Yeah.
Or no, Army of Darkness is great. I literally just bought like a NECA figure of Ash from the ending. Or I guess one of the endings where he's back working at S-Mart. in his little like shop boy outfit with a shotgun with the price tag still on it. So precious. It's so cute. We have such an Army of Darkness and Evil Dead collection in this home. It's needless and delightful. There's like a giant box set that came out a few years ago of the first two movies and the show. And I've bought it like five times because I would buy it and then I'd be like, ooh, and I should sell it. And then I would buy it again and then I would sell it. And then also like anytime the holidays come around, I just buy it for friends because it's like not super expensive and it's like big and glorious and like it's basically all the Evil Dead movies except for Army of Darkness. So like,
why isn't Army of Darkness in it?
Rights reasons. Okay. The show and the first two movies are all held by like I think Lionsgate Studio Canal, but Army of Darkness is owned by Universal. So
yes, it does have that Universal logo.
You gotta just buy the Scream Factory release with all 17 versions of that movie.
I know.
It's too many. That and Blade Runner. Like, calm down, guys.
Yeah.
Just pick one.
What about you? What have you been watching?
I had the great fortune of going to see a beloved early 2000s horror movie in theaters recently because it was the 20th anniversary of Rob Zombie's House of 1,000 Corpses. All 1,000 of them back in theaters. It was so goddamn fun. I totally forgot that fucking Walton Goggins from Righteous Gemstones is in that movie.
I had no idea.
He plays a like deputy who gets who along with Tom Tolles from Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer go to investigate the house and get murdered. It's so goddamn fun. I haven't seen that movie since I was in like high school. I don't think.
Yeah, I only saw it once when it came out. That's it.
Seeing it with like contemporary eyes after getting so much more into like more deep cut art and like horror films, it feels more like an art film than a horror film. And it feels so much more like a Ken Russell movie than a Toby Hooper movie. It's insane. It like totally loves Altered States more than it does Texas Chainsaw, and that is a reason to love it. I've never loved it more. It was so goddamn fun and really upsetting, really terrifying. It's unrelenting in every way imaginable. It's a great time.
Maybe
Rob Zombie's underrated as hell.
I'm not a fan, as I've stated, but I think I owe a rewatch of that in the Devil's Rejects. Devil's Rejects I kind of liked when I saw it a little bit, but House of 1,000 Corpses I truly did not like when it came out.
I had most issues with that one when I first saw it, because it felt like a ride, it felt like a video game, it didn't really feel like a movie, it felt like a music video, it felt like a lot of things. But with, like, hindsight, it's very a lot more cohesive and insane of a movie. I don't know. It feels like he was mainlining Kenneth Anger and Ken Russell and then slathered it on top of a Toby Hooper screenplay. It's
my super issue with fun. Him is my same issue that I have with Gregor Rocky, which is that I think he's got a great eye, but I think he's a bad writer. Frankly. I really hate the way that he writes dialogue.
That's fair. That's fair. I understand that, and that's a very a fitting criticism from a writer.
I also really hated his version of Halloween, like, with my whole heart, and I found it unforgivable. I saw someone tweet recently that it was better than the actual movie Halloween from 1978, and I was like, that's a death penalty tweet.
I like the Mountain Dew Halloween movies, what can I say?
The Mountain Dew Halloween movies. Oh boy, but they are. They really are the Mountain Dew Halloween movies.
They always remind me of my friends that I went to middle school with, my cousins and stuff, that were like drinking Mountain Dew all the time instead of water.
Me.
And listening to Slipknot.
I started drinking coffee in college so that I could replace Mountain Dew.
Oh no.
Yeah, I'm a true hillbilly, really, I am.
It's delightful.
Well, listen, this is Halloween. We always do a special double feature for these kinds of holidays, and this is a great idea that I had and Drew had that we combined. So it started a while back where I had the idea to do a highbrow, lowbrow double feature. And then later, Drew had the great idea to do a double feature of complementary Cronenberg and Hennenlotter films. So we just smashed these two ideas together and decided to do a double feature on a theme, the theme being addiction. And so we decided to do...
Cronenlotter.
Cronenlotter, yes. We did Cronenberg's Naked Lunch, and we did Hennenlotter's Brain Damage. And we're going to start as the just as the phrase highbrow, lowbrow does with the highbrow, and start with from 1991 by director David Cronenberg. It is Naked Lunch.
William Lee, I am your case officer. You are my agent. I in turn report to your controller. Your wife is not really your wife. She is an agent of Interzone Incorporated. You must kill her.
Where were you this morning?
I got in a bit of a jam. They're saying that you escaped from custody and murdered your wife, and they want you.
You're just gonna have to leave town. And Interzone is the only place that will have a shady character like you at such short notice.
I had never seen this before.
You'd never seen this before, ever?
No. I've never read the book either.
Oh my god. This was so fucking formative for me. So, the really important rewind for a sec. When I was like very early into getting into horror movies and getting into movies, period, getting like, I had no friends. I was in the ninth grade and I had a public library with a vast amount of DVDs and film books. I had the New York Times Best Thousand Movies from 1998 with like reviews from New York Times critics. And then I had a library full of Criterion DVDs. And so I would go through and I'd watch stuff. And I remember getting Videodrome because I heard people say that Videodrome was incredible. And I loved Videodrome so much that I was like, what else did this Cronenberg guy make? And mm-hmm. The only other ones that my library had were Dead Ringers and Naked Lunch. The two like artsiest ones he made.
Yeah.
Nothing like Videodrome at all. It wasn't Scanners. It wasn't The Fly. I went straight into those, and I'd never heard of Burroughs. I'd never heard of The Beats. I had never heard of anything like that. And I just put on Naked Lunch sight unseen as like, this is like a weird surrealist horror movie. Let's give it a shot. And it blew my brain outside of the backside of my skull. I had no idea what the fuck I'd just seen. I hated it. But I couldn't leave it alone. I had the DVD for another week and I stayed up all night. I remember flipping through my New York Times book being like, there's no way this thing's in here. And it was. And I was like, how the fuck is that Naked Lunch movie in here? And I remember reading the review and it was like screaming the praises of it. And I was like, okay. So I watched it again a few days later and I was like, I still don't really get it, but I think I get it. And then I, like, read more stuff about it and that, like, yeah, the book is unadaptable, so a lot of it's based on Burroughs' life, like, bleeding into his text. And so then I went to my high school's library, where for some fucking reason they had the book, which, my God, I'm shocked they did. In, like, the most conservative school I ever attended had it, and I'm so thankful. And I remember sitting in science classes in my entire high school career, I would check that book out all the time. It took me years before I finally just bought it. And I would just read Naked Lunch in class all the time. Which as like a deviant little teenager, you should not be this. It's one of the most erotically fucked up books you could possibly read. It's horny as hell in a really sick and fucked way. On top of being like, you know, a demented story about addiction and it's basically poetry. It is true. And you know, people call it sci-fi. People call it horror. It's batshit. And it was one that discovering the movie, causing me to discover the book and causing me to discover like such a deeper wealth of Cronenberg than if I just started with Scanners and stuff like that, really kind of formed who I became in a lot of ways. Burroughs is my favorite author, like, end all be all. I have all of his books. I've read almost all of his books. And when I say favorite author, I mean, like, the works that I enjoy the most. I don't mean, like, I love what he did. This guy, I love him. Oh, my God. Kill your wife. Let's go, queen. That's not what I mean. But this was your first time watching the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about the book, or did you just go in entirely blind?
I knew that it had something to do with, like, bugs, basically. I mean, so my history of this is, I was a 90s teenager, so I was familiar with Cronenberg to an extent. You know, Scanners, Videodrome, The Fly, those were kind of on the periphery, and I'd seen those. I didn't watch this. I remember it existing. I remember seeing it at the video store and thinking, based on what I knew of it, that I would find it boring and avoiding it. Which is probably true as a teenager, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I also never read it because as much as I liked to read and still, you know, I'm a big reader. I did try to read the Beats in high school because as I was saying to you off mic, a lot of the cute boys at school really liked the Beatniks. And so I wanted to like the Beatniks. So I tried reading Kerouac, which I hated.
Yeah.
And so I just never gave the Beats another chance outside of like poems like Howl by Allen Ginsberg, because mm-hmm. poetry is kind of its own thing. So I just never tried to read Burroughs. And now I'm sorry that I didn't, because I really liked this movie a lot. I thought it was so cool. It's incomprehensible to me. I had to read like synopses to kind of understand what was going on. But that's cool too. I mean, just a super cool movie. I loved it.
Yeah. Okay, let's give it a shot describing the plot of this movie just for a sec.
Jesus Christ. Okay,
So RoboCop does bug drugs. The end.
First of all, what is this character's name? William?
Bill Lee.
Bill Lee is...
Which is William S. Burroughs' is like pseudonym that he uses for a lot of autobiographical stuff that he wrote.
Got it. So it's 1953 in New York. Bill Lee is a professional exterminator who runs out of the powder one day on a job. It's the powder that kills bugs. And discovers that his wife has been shooting it up like heroin. This leads him to being questioned by the police, who leave the room. And then a typewriter comes to life and starts and like sort of informs him that he's a secret agent and that
a typewriter cockroach.
Yes.
That speaks from its anus.
That speaks from its like anus mouth hole. tells him about Innerzone, which is in North Africa, that his wife may be a secret agent from Innerzone and he has to kill her. Then he does by playing a game called William Tell, where she puts a glass on her head and he shoots it and he ends up shooting her in the head. And then that puts him on the run. He goes to Innerzone. He's like interfacing with these typewriter bug secret agents. I'm kind of losing my train of thought here. there's a bug man named Mugwump who he's like meeting with from time to time. He goes to North Africa. There's all sorts of homos around. I don't know. Help me out here.
The majority of the movie is set in quote unquote Innerzone, which is essentially Northern Africa, the 1950s, where if you know much about certain kind of literature, Burroughs spent a lot of his time, but also Paul and Jane Bowles both spent a long time there as well. Obviously, he wrote Sheltering Sky there. She wrote Two Serious Ladies a little bit before they moved there. They were both big, prominent authors of that period. They were both gay as fuck. They both lived there and like had affairs with other people. And he shows up there and there's like ciphers of Jane and Paul Bowles, Ian Holm from Alien playing the Paul Bowles cipher, who has like a harem of young boys that he keeps around him. That, I mean, like 1920 when I say young boys. Who cares? And then Judy Davis, who had been playing Burroughs' wife that he killed, shows up as the a doppelganger as the Jane Bull cipher as well. He is instructed by his bug agent overlords to disguise himself as a homosexual, because homosexuality is the best cover an agent ever had. That way he can get down to some serious work. Meanwhile, he's writing up these reports that the bugs tell him to, and sending them back. Later in the movie, his friends that are ciphers for Kerouac and Ginsberg show up, and they're like, "You're still in New York. What are you doing? We're in New York right now. What reports? You've been sending us these excerpts called Naked Lunch. They're great. We've been editing them for you. Here you are."
Yeah.
Roy Scheider is also in it as the sinister Dr. Benway, who's a character from the book, who is pushing people onto black tar centipede to get them off of the bug powder. You also have a very sinister Julian Sands.
Great Julian Sands performance.
His best performance, I think.
Yeah.
Who at one point turns into a massive bug himself. and it basically, the text of the book and the you know, heroin-induced delusions of genre films and, you know, fantasy novels kind of take over the plot and the narrative. It's super weird to describe. It's really hard to sell the ending in a way that makes sense, other than he is accepting his life as a writer by recreating horrendous acts that he performed. And I don't know, the idea of the typewriter being the weapon, the instrument that you use to write, being one of violence is very tied into this story. And it's this whole movie is basically nerd fanfic for fans of mid-century counterculture authors.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a background on that stuff, it's just insanity.
It's insanity, I think, even if you do.
It's
a weird movie.
But if you like it, it's a good gateway drug into those authors, into those works, which is how I discovered all of that stuff. And I am a better, more well-rounded person who doesn't murder wives, I think.
Yeah, it should be said, in case we didn't say this directly, that William S. Burroughs did in fact kill his actual wife in this way. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison, which was then thrown out, but so he didn't have to serve it. But
this was in Mexico, by the way.
Yeah. And he has said that unfortunately he credits that murder to his writing career.
Yeah.
There is an interesting, first of all, how much would you pay for a bug typewriter, like one of these?
Oh my god, tens of thousands of dollars to just have in my house.
Yeah.
Wait, are we saying functional or just a prop?
No, just decorative.
Oh yeah, still tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. It does kind of set up writing as an addiction, which I think is an interesting thing. It kind of reminded me of the way Arabato treats the camera, like where the camera is the vampire, the film is the vampire.
The typewriter is
that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the typewriter makes demands. It some of them jizz, literally have orgasms.
And while writing on them in a way that feels pleasurable, they grow into erogenous creatures that defy gender. And then flop around humping things. It's like they grow penises. All the mugwumps have a big antenna thing on the top of their head that
secretes. Sea monkeys.
Yeah, that it's a phallus, first of all.
Yeah.
And it secretes a milky thick fluid that is addictive, and that all the young boys here are addicted to. And it's that's just jizz.
They do name it as jism near the end of the movie. Ian Holm does, I think.
The phrase jism is used frequently in this book.
I liked the aesthetic of this a lot. I really liked the production design because when I think of Cronenberg, I think of like very wealthy environments that are kind of minimalist and chic. And instead of this, we're getting like the opposite. We're getting interiors that are really dirty and dingy and painted like green or yellow. And we're getting like a lot of mid-century design and like a grimy downtown New York kind of aesthetic. And then later a Tangiers aesthetic. It's just not what I think of when I think of David Cronenberg.
It's so beautifully done. Like even when he's doing dingy, it's a very like almost artificially and like put together dingy. This movie like has such a great like sandy brown patina to the whole thing that like covers every scene, and it's super super gorgeous. It's also like should be noted that like this came out in like 1991. So immediately after Dead Ringers and immediately after The Fly. So this is like truly he had the most cachet of his entire career. This movie was produced by Jeremy Thomas, who had just won Best Picture for producing The Last Emperor. and was like, this is one of the biggest budgets Cronenberg ever got. This is how he spent it. $17 million.
Yeah.
Jamie Heineman from Mythbusters was one of the special effects guys on this movie, making the mugwumps and typewriters. And it was like partially produced and distributed by 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
It should also be noted the same year and a few months apart from when they released another movie that's also a period film, that's also a super brown patina, that also features Judy Davis, being the paramour of a writer who mysteriously dies, Barton Fink.
Oh, I didn't put that together.
Barton Fink came out from Fox the same year as this movie, and they have so many parallels.
Yeah.
It's super weird.
Apparently this was like a pretty critical success while being a box office flop, which is like not surprising.
Massive box office. The only people that I know for certain that actually saw this movie in theaters are Nelson and Bart on The Simpsons.
I forgot about that. That's so funny.
Which has a great gag of them just walking out of a theater with a marquee that just says Naked Lunch, and Nelson Muntz just says, I can think of two problems with that title.
You know, whenever a movie has like critical praise but audience derision, I always find that I like it. I think the common wisdom is that critics are dumb and don't know what they're talking about, but I always find that I side with critics and not audiences. Maybe I'm an elitist. I probably am.
This is like the highest example of a movie that like upon release the general public had no fucking clue what to do with. And just predominantly hate it. Again, the first time I saw it, I had no idea what I was watching, and I fucking hated it. I was also like 14. But like, it's just, if you don't know what you're expecting, and you just hear the title, and you have no idea about the book or anything like that, I mean, William S. Burroughs had a bit of a resurgence in the late 80s and early 90s. He's in Drugstore Cowboy. Kurt Cobain was a big fan of his and was listing him off as one of his favorite writers. They did a collab album together, which is really weird. Burroughs was putting out albums on like Island Records in the 80s and 90s, where he'd like they'd have musicians come in and like play weird jazz grunge tracks over him talking about the phallus of the monster.
And as I said, like I as a teen of this era of not this era of the movie, but of the 90s, like people were reading the Beats and Burroughs included. It was like very cool.
Burroughs did like Nike commercials.
Yeah.
In the 80s and 90s. He was like kind of a weird pop culture figure again around the time this movie was made. And there's such cute photos of him and Cronenberg on set in like a room surrounded by like 20 mugwump props and stuff like that. I mean, he loved it. He had a great time and was very involved. Obviously, critics loved it because, again, Cronenberg was at the top of his game at the time. It's an incredibly literary movie that is, you know, adapted with the same special effects as, like, The Thing. Mm-hmm. So all those film critics that had so much fun in the 80s deriding The Howling and The Thing and all the special effects movies at the time then got to celebrate this as being, well, if you use special effects for literary stuff, then it's art. Then it's great.
The practical effects here truly are astounding.
There's not been nothing like them, and they are really weird and incredible.
So buggy and gloopy and icky, and I loved them.
They're so tactile and wet, and like special CGI could never get anywhere near what this movie does, because the thing that makes Burroughs as a writer work is his stuff is so experienced and so earthy, and it's so like, it's like he's always writing about jism and bodies and flesh and sweat. So he makes sense with Cronenberg. Cronenberg's always like, it's a very similar obsession with the body, and the way Cronenberg is more interested in the way that the body betrays itself. Burroughs is more interested in the way that bodies betray each other. My favorite Burroughs, Cities of the Red Night, is about a sexually transmitted plague that makes people like overly horny freaks.
That sounds like Shivers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it's great. He wrote it in the 80s, so he probably saw Shivers. Like,
yeah,
it's fucking like, I don't know. This movie straddles the line of being like, this is the artsiest movie Cronenberg ever made. Like, A Dangerous Method is like, you know, a slow kind of movie about Sigmund Freud, sure, but this is like a different level of art film.
Yes.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
I think that that's true, but I would also say, weirdly, that this movie feels like funnier than most Cronenberg movies. It feels like more playful. Like, it's kind of like reveling in the grossness, sort of like we talked about Singapore Sling a few episodes ago. Like, it feels like gloopy in like a childish way that is really charming to me.
Yeah, and like, again, the humping typewriter monsters are like supposed to be a little funny.
Yeah,
honestly, the person who's having the most fun this entire movie is Roy Scheider, who I don't know why he's here. I don't know what was going on with Roy Scheider. He is having so much fun in this role. You see him a little bit in the beginning as Dr. Benway, and then you just forget about him. And then he shows up at the end, basically inside of another character.
Yeah.
And, like, he shows up, and he's so gleeful about it. And then, like, all the creatures, like, shout his name, like, a little, like, applause. It's so fun! But this movie is also, like, emotionally devastating to a degree. I got to see it a few years ago when Beyond Fest did their Cronenberg retrospective. They showed almost all of his movies. They had him in town. They printed shirts that said Cronenberg for president. And I was really, really taken aback. I probably hadn't seen it since high school at that point. I was, like, welling up, especially near the end of this movie, because it's really about, I mean, again, he murders his wife twice, essentially, in this movie.
Yeah.
But it's also about, like, surrendering yourself and, like, absolving the self and killing the ego and surrendering the body to the, like, idea of art and accepting that you are nothing, just but a vessel for all of this, which is a similar idea that movies like Babylon were getting at in a big, bombastic and messy way. And I love that. I love that message so much. Again, like, writing being an addiction that's going to kill you.
Yeah.
And it's worth it.
Do you know what I love is the line, it's a Kafka high. It makes you feel like a bug.
I think about that all the time.
Yeah.
Cronenberg is so goddamn funny. This is definitely his funniest movie. It's so goddamn underrated. I I remember, and that's the other thing that's insane about this movie. It's distributed by Fox, which is now owned by the Mouse. Disney now owns Naked Lunch.
Yeah.
A few years ago, a friend of mine was selling a bunch of his movies and wanted, because he was like, I don't need these things. And I'm like, I'm downsizing and stuff. And one of them was a Blu-ray of Naked Lunch. And I was like, I will take. Yes, please. and then like 6 months later, he came back over to my house and was like, hey, I thought I got rid of all that stuff because I thought they were all on streaming. And Naked Lunch is nowhere on streaming. And I was like, yeah, man. Like, Netflix is not programming this anytime soon.
Yeah, I remember when Disney bought Fox, there was a lot of hand-wringing because there was a lot of, that meant that there was a lot of Fox titles it would be hard to see in theaters. Like Alien was a big one that people talked about. They had to carve out something special for Rocky Horror Picture Show, I remember. Because Disney really puts things in vaults and they're not out here like allowing their prints to go to repertory theaters very often. So yeah. Like a lot of these old Fox titles are going to be really hard to see in a place like The Egyptian or Alamo or whatever.
And that's, I mean, that's, movies is varied from Valley of the Dolls, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, Myra Breckinridge, which is one of my favorite and for me most important trans counterculture films of all time. They're never going to let that back out, especially not for home video ever again.
Yeah.
That never got a Blu-ray. It had a DVD, and we'll probably never get another release of that movie. And, you know, God bless Criterion for, like, getting movies like Naked Lunch out and being able to continue to make deals with Disney to occasionally get random shit like this out. But, like, dying on the vine. And now, I don't know if you saw, there's been some hoopla. One of the Fox titles that Disney now owns is The French Connection, the William Friedkin movie. It won Best Picture, also with Roy Scheider.
Yep.
Disney recut it and cut out an entire scene because the main character says the N-word. Yep. Because the main character is a fucking racist, and that's the point of that movie.
Yeah.
And there's just a jump cut in the middle of a scene, and that's the version that's only now available to stream. That's what's on HBO Max. That's what's on, able for rent on iTunes. That's the only one, unless you go and buy a used DVD or Blu-ray, that's the only way to now watch The French Connection, is the way that Disney has now edited and censored it. God forbid they get a hold of Naked Lunch and actually look at what's in the film.
Yeah.
It's truly, it's like, imagine if you recut all of examples of things like that out of Taxi Driver.
I mean, my God.
Travis Bickle can't say fag.
Travis Bickle can say faggot. I am telling you here now. let's play a quick round of Have They Seen It for this, like one each, because we do have a whole other movie to get to. You mentioned that Bart Simpson saw Naked Lunch. This person came to my mind out of the clear blue sky. It's a person that I do not like and got in trouble for making fun of once on Twitter from my boss. Do you think that Amanda Palmer has seen Naked Lunch?
Oh.
The person with the worst eyebrows of all time.
The person, one of the worst human beings of all time.
Yeah.
Big ol' sucko. I don't think so. I feel like maybe she saw it in the 90s because everyone was hating it and she was like, I'm gonna go see it. And yeah. I feel like maybe in the 90s she was like, it's great. And then over time, she never watched it again and was like, actually, that movie sucks.
Yeah.
I could see her being like that. Her partner on the other, or former partner or whatever, Neil Gaiman,
for sure.
Has definitely seen this movie. I feel for like sure, he for sure. loves this movie.
Yes.
Amanda Palmer, if you're listening to this, I'm a trans person telling you to go fuck yourself.
Yeah, we hate you. We hate your guts.
We hate you. Bye. As mentioned, this movie was released by Fox in 1991. And also starred Judy Davis. Weirdly enough, the same time she also did Barton Fink, which was also released by Fox in 1991. And both of them separately had weird Bart-related gags on The Simpsons.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
So do you think that partial star of Barton Fink, Steve Buscemi, ever saw Naked Lunch.
I mean, he really could have been in it, to be honest.
He's got the eyes to play a mugwump.
He's the buggiest
man in Hollywood.
He seems cool and smart. I would think he would. And I think he would like it, don't you?
I think he would love this movie. I'm just imagining Steve Buscemi on the set of Arrowheads pitching Brendan Fraser on Naked Lunch.
Brendan Fraser, I think, would also like this movie.
I think Brendan Fraser would love this movie. It has the same like visual language as The Mummy. Come on, dude.
Yeah. My friend John is an actor on a TBS show called Miracle Workers with Steve Buscemi. That's what I'm getting
Buscemi.
At. John said that he learned that it's actually pronounced Buscemi, and he asked Steve Buscemi why he doesn't insist that people say that. And he was like, meh. he's like, people seem to think it's Buscemi. I'm fine with that. It's so funny that literally all people say his name wrong, even when they know the correct pronunciation.
Same thing with Brendan Fraser. Everyone pronounced it like the Kelsey Grammer show from the 90s his entire life, and it took until the Whale campaign for him to be like, guys, it's Fraser.
Yeah.
Please, just, like, Razor. God, please. If we could... And when they announced his name for the Oscar, they still said it wrong, and he was like, whatever, I got an Oscar.
The wickedly talented Adele Dazeem.
Yeah, listen, if you're showing up to the Oscars, expect your name will not be read properly. Yeah.
Okay, we've covered the highbrow. Time to move on to the lowbrow. And
speaking
listen
of Academy Award winners, Frank Henenlotter.
We don't mean lowbrow in a derogatory mean way. We love this movie. We love this director.
We just mean this was 42nd Street, like a street trash grimy kind of movie.
Yeah. Don't be a little bitch about
God
it, in other
bless.
Words. Don't at us about using the term lowbrow. From 1988, directed by Frank Henenlotter, it is, of course, Brain Damage.
It's funny. One night you go to bed, and when you wake up, everything is different. Now Brian's acting a little peculiar.
He's like a completely different person. I don't even know him anymore.
Something's gotten into him.
Sometimes everything glows with a different kind of light deep
into him.
What are you telling me? That we killed someone last night?
Something bad. Something slimy.
What are you doing?
Something very...
I know something's happened to you.
Very...
How is that?
Hungry.
Now, this movie I have a history with. I saw it in the early 2000s on the Lower East Side in my friend's apartment. I had seen Basket Case and I had seen Frankenhooker, but I had never even heard of this. And at that time, it was pretty rare. He had like an out of print VHS or something. You know, it was like kind of before it kind of got rediscovered by who did the re-release of this? Arrow?
Arrow eventually did, yes.
Yeah. So now it's like pretty readily available. It's on Shudder and other places, and it feels like a lot more people had seen it. But then it was pretty rare, and I loved it. And it is, I have to say, it's my favorite Frank Henenlotter movie. And I pitched doing it earlier on our show, but we decided to do Frankenhooker instead, which is another movie I love. But this is my favorite. What's your history with this, and how do you like it?
I have a very weird 2000s history with this movie. Because it involves the angry video game nerd.
Yes, you've brought up this person a lot, and I've then Googled this person. So I had no history with that guy at all. But I now have some understanding of who that person
was/is. Yeah, he is alive. Though his internet prominence is not what it was, say, in 2010. Sheltered kid. I literally just said I had no friends when I was in like ninth grade or whatever. But when I eventually like made friends and stuff like that and started a band, I felt like the first thing that I found out that we all had in common was that we all had been watching James Rolfe on YouTube, who is known as the Angry Video Game Nerd. I don't give a fuck about video games. I'm so sorry to report. If that's you, I apologize. I don't give a shit. But he had a side thing in October. He would do Cinemassacre, and he would talk about horror movies that he loved.
Okay.
And so I found him through that, because he would talk about Ed Wood, and he would talk about, you know, crazy shit like that. And so he would do little, like, 5-minute videos every day in October, listing off 31 horror movies that he loved, and one of them was Brain Damage. And, you know, in like 5-minute snippets, it's just a loud, screamy YouTube man going, "Oh, shit! Oh! Oh, this little fucking thing's on his head! Oh, god damn!" That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, this movie looks crazy! Whatever. I would like to see it one day. Super out of print, super hard to find. But I found out about a lot of really good horror movies that way. And then I think it honestly took until the Arrow restoration for me to finally see this movie. I've seen it a whole bunch of times since.
Yeah.
I also got to see it at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. They did a triple feature with Basket Case, this, and Frankenhooker. One of the best nights I've ever had in the theater. Of course. Good Lord. I love this movie. A friend of mine, who is a trans film writer and programmer in Los Angeles, just programmed this for a trans series that she's been doing called They Didn't Say It, which basically means, like, projecting transness onto movies that aren't explicitly not trans.
Right.
As, like, a trans male reading of Brain Damage, which, fuck yeah. You know what? Yes.
Yeah.
You're obsessed by a sudden, like, penis-shaped monster that's growing on your brain and telling you to do things. I know a lot of trans guys that can relate to this idea.
I feel like Cronenberg and Hennenlotter are both, like, sort of trans filmmakers without actually being it, or at least very queer. I mean, I know trans people have written extensively about Cronenberg and his filmmaking around surgeries and, like, you know what I mean? Like, people, trans people really imprint on Cronenberg for sure.
Yeah, we do. I think Frank Henlotter is a very trans filmmaker.
Brain Damage Frankenhooker very, is like
Frankenhooker is like an explicitly trans feminine yeah. movie. And I think this is a very trans mask film. And like there's a lot of queer readings to the Basket Case trilogy in the same way that there are to like Clive Barker's Nightbreed and stuff like that, of like, you know, this idea of like having a secret that you have to hide from people and like the like kind of community of like freaks and mutants and things like that. I think his movies are really beautiful and crazy and awesome. This is one of his, I think visually Brain Damage is his best.
It's so good. It looks gorgeous. So fucking
good. It is bathed in like the most beautiful blues the entire movie, and then you get these nice bright bursts of like purples and pinks that cut through. It is delightful.
Yeah. So this movie follows Brian, who's a young 20 something living in the Lower East Side with his brother. Both of them are exceptionally hot, so thank you Frank Henenlotter for always casting beefcakes in your movies. Brian has a girlfriend and everything is fine, and then one day he wakes up and there's blood all over his bed, and a little monster in a bathtub named Elmer has been feeding off of him. And what happens when Elmer feeds off you is that you stick Elmer on your neck. His mouth opens up and he sticks a little needle into your brain and injects it with blue liquid, which makes you high as a kite and allows Elmer to manipulate you to walk the city streets and eat so that he can eat people's brains. And what rolls out of this is sort of a, like, I don't know, Little Shop of Horrors-esque kind of narrative where Elmer's demands on Brian get greater and greater and greater and more macabre, and Brian starts to resist but can't really because he's addicted to the drug that he gets from Elmer. And I don't know, what am I missing? I feel like...
There's also an old... he finds Elmer because an old couple
in his building.
That live in his building have been, like, treating him like a pet or a son and, like, keeping him at arm's length, kind of, while utilizing him. thinking that he'll keep them alive forever or something.
Yeah.
And the minute that Elmer switches over to Brian, they just become, like, deranged junkies.
Yeah. And they do something that I love, which is, like, the two old people, or at least the male of that couple, seems to be some sort of, like, professor or historian, and that's why he has Elmer. So you do get this long monologue halfway through the movie from that character who's like, he was part of the Roman Empire, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Like, the entire history of Elmer and the way
he's
that
like,
he's
like, he's
like
a minion.
Yeah.
He's like the minions. He's been there all along.
Yeah. It's great.
This movie gets some really delightful body horror out of Brian, as Elmer breaks his fucking brain apart, and he gets little, like, lesions and bumps growing all over him. There's, like, a snowman kind of thing that pops out of his brain. He's leaking blue goop from his scalp and his mouth, and there's some really, really disturbing scenes. One of the most beautiful set pieces, though, is kind of his first high.
Mm-hmm.
He's laying in his bed, and it just gets, like, his whole body gets submerged in this blue water and this kind of like torrent.
It's gorgeous.
So sumptuous. We also get some of the most 42nd Street kind of kills. Like, if you haven't seen Basket Case and aren't like, or Frankenhooker or anything like that, and don't like know what you're in for, there is a very specific back alley murder
after
a nightclub scene.
Yeah.
That is like, this is what these movies are.
Yeah.
In which Elmer seems to be hiding in Brian's pants
mm-hmm.
to attack someone in their throat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's awesome.
There's he casts a really interesting. Frankenmuller is heterosexual, right?
I believe so.
On paper,
yeah.
At least, because he
on paper at least, maybe in like the Guy Madden and David Cronenberg heterosexual way.
He does a lot of favors for the gay men because he casts these like beautiful men in all of his movies, and then the girlfriend in this is just sort of like, she's a nice, normal, pretty looking girl, but the two brothers are just like so hot. And then he casts this beefcake to be naked in a shower, and I googled it. I was like, what's the deal with gayness and brain damage? And he was like, I just thought it would be funny to have like a beefcake in the shower. It's like, I guess it's funny, but it's also like super hot. And it makes Brian seem like he is like struggling with his sexuality in some kind of
yeah.
way. Like it injects all of this innuendo into the movie that I don't know that Frankenmuller like really anticipated or intended so much as he just like thought it would be funny to have a naked man in a shower.
It kind of reminds me of the Tom Holland written movie, The Beast Within,
mm-hmm.
from the 80s, which is also like no one involved with making it thought that this was a parable for homosexuality. But now everyone watching it is like, yeah, it's because he's gay. Like, he's reckoning with his homosexuality. That's this whole movie.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I guess Nightmare Part 2 is the, like,
totally.
Really big example of that.
And that,
the beefcake dude in this shows back up in Frankenhooker,
yes, he plays
too.
The pimp Zorro in Frankenhooker. I couldn't find out much else about him. They found him in a gym randomly. Like, some assistant from this, like, went to a gym and just found him. And is like, hey, will you be in a movie naked? And he was like, sure.
Hell yeah, brother.
He's got an incredible body. He's super hot. So I would do it, too, if I looked like him.
Oh, my God.
What else? It's fun to see 80s Manhattan, as always. I really like horror movies that are set in cities, and they're kind of rare. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got the Frankenlauter movies, you've got Candyman, you've got Poltergeist 3, which I always loved as a kid, because it's like sort of yuppies in the big city.
I feel like the two biggest proponents of that subgenre are Frankenlauter and then Larry Cohen.
Yes. Very,
Larry
very
Cohen
correct.
Is always going to give you like a New York set, like Cue the Winged Serpent and like The Stuff. And they're all, The Stuff is, I feel like, it feels a little bit more suburban and it gets rural near the end. But like, they're always going to give, like, the big shootout at the end of like the It's Alive movies are always like, we're in the city now. Okay, yeah. Cool. The baby's in the sewer like an alligator.
Yeah. And you've never seen the Larry Cohen film, God Told Me To, right?
No, I still need to. You'd but like I it know a that's lot. Another big
Talk
city
about
one.
A trans
yeah.
movie. That's one. Ooh. Yeah, oh yeah, without spoiling too much.
The other one I need to see is Private Parts, the not the
Howard Stern biopic.
Because I've already seen that one. but the Paul Bartel movie.
Oh yeah, I've never seen that
from
either.
The 70s yeah. is supposed to be a very New York apartment set yeah. and kind of trans movie. Super weird.
I feel like the other urban horror movies are like black horror movies. Like, anyway, I mentioned Candyman, but in the 90s especially we would get like Tales from the Hood, or we would get like a black urban a franchise film like Leprechaun in the Hood or Halloween Resurrection yeah. or and so like you would get those too, but that's kind of it for urban horror.
It's always something that I think about because I'm like, I, as someone who's lived in apartments for a lot of my adult life, like a haunted apartment is both more realistic and scarier than a haunted house.
Yeah,
I mean, of course, like, apartment horror is always going to be Roman Polanski's fucking...
The trilogy.
Mastery. But, like, there's... You're, like, in a small space, cramped a bunch of weirdo fucking strangers. I mean, there's a great subway sequence in Brain Damage where he's just, like, at his wit's end. And we get a weird crossover cameo from the star of Basket
from
Case.
Basket Case, yeah. Love that he's still out there doing his thing.
He's still going. But this movie gets really goopy and really upsetting. I mean, some of the gore in this gets like when he just starts pulling out of his ear.
Yeah.
Just parts of his brain.
Yeah.
That's.
But okay. Even the puppet of Elmer, like my boyfriend Joel, anytime that Elmer opened his mouth and all those needles would come out, he's like, I can't stand this.
That's at least fine for me. That's at least because I think Elmer is cute as hell.
I hate him. I think he looks disgusting. I think it's funny that his voice is like Bing Crosby's voice.
I know!
The voice is
well, howdy there.
Yeah.
Why don't you just little stop part on that little brainstem there? I'll have a little Succarino. He's such a delight.
Yeah.
Honestly, as much as I would pay for a Mugwump typewriter from Naked Lunch, I would probably pay for a like scale replica of Elmer to sit on my bookcase.
Yeah, I'd pay for that.
He's cute. I'm sorry. Like, if you, I know a lot of people love The Tingler,
mm-hmm.
the Vincent Price movie. I'm not here to knock The Tingler. I have a friend who has like a life size Tingler in his house, and I'm like, that's awesome. I want Elmer.
Elmer, I guess, is at moments he's like meant to be a phallic symbol. Like literally, he becomes that at more than one moment. But also, he looks like a dookie. Is that intentional too? Do you think? Like,
I feel like potentially, but also I feel like that's unintentional. And then Hannah Lunner was like, "Hell yeah, cool. He looks like shit. Sweet."
Yeah, literally,
but
he's looks like shit.
His head is a brain, essentially, that yeah. gets larger and larger as the movie goes on. I don't know. He's so fucking crazy. He's such a weird little goblin, little fucking gremlin.
Do you
man.
Know who he looks like and, in the oh, face? He looks like Meatball from Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
Yes, he
His
does.
His head looks like that.
I have just now found out that there is someone on Etsy who makes Elmer mannequin, makes like figures that
How
are
much?
Like handmade. $200.
Could be worth it.
Could be worth it, honestly. Oh my god, and he's like sitting on a brain.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, that's fucking sick. They're handmade. They look incredible. I might need
you might
to get
splurge
that.
For that. I, you know what I wanted.
Let's hope
from,
I get a tax return.
Do you know what I wanted from Naked Lunch? Was there's the gay escort Kiki? I think his name is. He wears a necklace.
Kiki.
That has like a, it's like a silver centipede necklace. And it's like, I would pay a lot of money for that.
The most like grotesque body horror that happens in Naked Lunch is not shown. It's just a story that's told by Julian Sands and Kiki about a drag queen, or by Peter Weller to them, but a drag queen whose intestines are torn out by a car.
Oh my gosh.
Through the rectum, yeah. Which just sounds like something you would see in Brain Damage.
Yeah, totally.
So in terms of addiction stories,
yeah,
how do you think these two movies shape up against each other? Because very different stories about addiction, and they have different consequences, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brain Damage is an easier movie to digest, for like, not to do a pun of any kind, but like, it has a more linear story that you can follow. So on that level, it's more obvious than Naked Lunch is, I suppose. I think they're both really successful in what they're doing. Yeah, I would say that Brain Damage is like clearer just because the movie itself is clearer, but I don't think that that's necessarily like something that this movie has over Naked Lunch. It's just an easier movie.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
What do you think?
I agree very much so. I feel like Brain Damage also almost has like narrative elements you'd find in an after school special.
Yeah. Yeah.
About like, oh, I gotta help my brother out. He's going through such a tough time, and like kind of that kind of stuff. And like, he pays for his addiction, and it has a very kind of black and white view,
yeah,
of addiction, while also showing the like attractive nature of the substance itself. Meanwhile, I feel like Naked Lunch is a far more complex story about addiction.
Yes,
that is a lot less sexy.
Yeah,
a lot less. Like, you could, watching Brain Damage, you could kind of be like, I see why someone would want a brain slug. I get it.
Yeah.
I could have him on me for a little while. I can see it. In Naked Lunch, the entire movie, you're like, why are you huffing bug powder? What are you doing?
Yes.
But at the end of the day, I feel like Naked Lunch is less critical of addiction.
Yeah.
And more viewing it as like a disease of the body that's just something you have to deal with.
And as you pointed out, I think Naked Lunch at least partially implies that the addiction might be worth it because you get to write. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't think that's what Brain Damage is saying at all.
No.
Brain Damage is like definitely a stand-in for heroin because, you know, Hannon Lunner did say that like everyone he knew in New York was doing heroin during this era. So,
yeah,
it's like a one to one.
Yeah, unsurprisingly. But I really, really love that he took a very serious subject that was directly affecting his life, and he made a goopy, funny, wild movie out of it, because there's more than one way to approach a topic.
Yeah.
Like, you can still, and it's still serious, and it's still, like, has a message, and it's still, you know, at the end of the day, warding people off of doing drugs, in a way. I'm sure Nancy Reagan loved this movie.
She did. And as funny as this is, and as, like, exploited it, you know, it's an exploitation movie, and it's, like, gloopy and silly, it's also, I think, imbued with a kind of sadness in a weird way that I don't think Frankenhooker, for example, has necessarily.
No, this is the most emotionally complex
Hennon
Lauder movie that I've seen.
Yes, which is funny to say because it's Hennon Lauder, but it's true.
It's true. I mean, I find Basket Case the hardest one to watch because Basket Case is, I mean, it's his earliest movie. It's very rough. Mm-hmm. It's very grimy. It feels like it has a lot of like narrative like push problems. It kind of drags in spots. Brain Damage is very easy to watch, but it's the most, like, woof, emotionally, like, devastating of his movies, because it's not a happy movie. It's a fun movie, but it's not a happy movie, and that's an important distinction. Like, you can tell a story that is sad, but in a fun way. Let's fucking go. You don't have to be on one tonal line the whole movie. You can vary and make it complex. That's two things that both of these movies really understand. And a lot of contemporary movies don't and feel so one note.
Yeah.
I should get off my soapbox.
These are such a great pairing. I mean, I just chose it based on the theme of addiction, having never seen Naked Lunch, but they went great together, I thought.
They both have weird little bug monsters.
Well, your that idea to
take
pair,
over your brain too.
Your idea to pair Cronenberg movies with complementary Hennon Lauder movies, I think, is so brilliant. And I wonder, like, what other pairs there that might go well together.
I mean, I feel like Basket Case would probably go best with Dead Ringers.
Mm-hmm. Of course, twins.
More than likely.
Twins is the theme.
But Frankenhooker is the one where I'm trying to decide whether it would go better with...
Crash?
Probably with... Yeah, I'm between Crash and Rabbit.
I think Rabbit is the one.
Yeah. Because it also has those great city scenes of her, like, mm-hmm. walking through downtown Montreal and, like, past a marquee for Carrie and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It has that great subway sequence.
Although that's not really a highbrow, lowbrow double feature, because that's kind of when Cronenberg was still lowbrow. It's like in his like early horror movie phase.
Rabbit might be his most, again, low, quote unquote, lowbrow movie. Nothing wrong with that. I love that movie. Even Shivers, which came before, I feel like has a lot more artsy highbrowness in it. Shivers, again, being maybe my favorite Cronenberg movie.
Love Shivers.
And of course, all of his features that he made before that are all super weird art movies that like most audiences cannot even begin to like finish. And that's fine.
Guess what my favorite Cronenberg movie is?
I'm thank you for posturing and posing for me. I'm almost gonna say Fast Company, his drag racing movie about cars and men who drive cars. I'm gonna say Videodrome.
It is The Brood.
Yeah, yeah. For Daddy Oliver Reed.
Yeah. I think it really like spans the gap between his earlier works and his later works pretty well. It's like John Waters' Polyester. Yeah. It's like a nice meeting point between early and later career.
Cronenberg feels like he's always doing movies in twos. Like they always seem packaged that way to me. Like in my head, I think of Shivers and Rabbit as being a little duo.
Yeah.
And then The Brood and Scanners as being a little duo. And then Videodrome and The Dead Zone as being a little duo. And then The Fly and Dead Ringers as being a little duo. And then M. Butterfly and Naked Lunch are a little duo.
Yeah.
Like, they kind of, like, lump together in that way. I guess, like, M. Butterfly and Crash make more sense together. Mm-hmm, and then on the other side of that, Naked Lunch and Existence kind of fit together. Yeah. I don't know. It's very interesting. And then, of course, he's got the Viggo Mortensen twofers and the... Robert Pattinson twofers. He really, and then now that we have Crimes of Future, he's going and making another movie like that.
I haven't seen any Cronenberg movies between Crash and Crimes of the Future.
You should check out Maps to the Stars.
Yeah.
I love Maps to the Stars. A History of Violence is very good. I haven't seen Eastern Promises. My Ivory loves that movie. She's been trying to get me to watch that with her. I haven't seen Spider. Mm-hmm. I own Spider. A friend of mine loaned it to me in college for like all of college, and I gave it back to him on watch. I've seen some of his shorts from that period too. Mm. Some are better than others. Also, you haven't seen Existence?
No, I never did.
Existence is very good.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
It's supposed to be getting a new physical media release soon, so maybe you can pick it up that way.
Well,
it's also streaming on the Criterion Channel.
Oh, yeah. We already determined that Nancy Reagan is the number one super fan of Brain Damage, but let's play Have
She has seen it, obviously, famously.
Do you think that Kurt Cobain ever saw Brain Damage?
I feel like he would. I feel like this is the kind of movie that he would have enjoyed.
Yeah,
he would have liked it, I think. I don't think he took the message to heart.
Addiction is a real bitch. I mean, you can take the message to heart and then still die of an overdose, because that's the way that addiction is.
Yeah. I feel like he probably definitely saw this. I feel like he would have enjoyed it. Oh my God. To be able to peruse Kurt Cobain's like VHS collection in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Over the Edge is.
I was gonna say, you know, his favorite movie is Over the Edge. That's like good taste.
Yeah, it's good fucking taste. Yeah. And like, I'm sure he had a tape of Naked Lunch and fucking a handful of great weirdo movies like that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of someone who is a very surprising fan of Brain Damage, but would totally love Brain Damage. Okay. So, 1988, I feel like, what else was happening in 1988? Like, it was a big time for television. A lot was going on at the time, and it was the first that American TV audiences got to experience the Canadian insanity that is Kids in the Hall.
Oh, my favorite sketch comedy show of all time.
So I'm wondering, and those guys fuck with genre and especially queerness all the time. Do you think, I'm just gonna pick at random Scott Thompson or Bruce McCullough. Do you think either of those two have seen Brain Damage? Scott Thompson, of course, is in Hannibal.
Yes. I'm going to go through all five of the kids like real quick. Bruce McCullough, yes. He is the weirdest of the kids. He's the artiest of them, too. He's the strangest sense of humor. Kevin, no. Scott, yes. Dave Foley, no. And Mark McKinney, no. So I think Bruce and Scott, yes.
I think Bruce and Scott, yes, I agree. Mark and Kevin, I agree and no. I feel like Dave Foley would have seen it.
You might be right. He's pretty intellectual.
And Dave Foley did eventually have a performance in a later movie that also featured him covered in a blue goo and an obsessive little kind of penis monster that tells people what to do. He was in Monkey Bone.
Oh, yeah.
Monkey Bone, which would make a great double feature. With Brain Damage.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for listening. This has been our Halloween double feature. If you liked this, please rate it 5 stars. Where you listen to podcasts, you can email us at bloodhousepod@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. Drusilla, where are you these days?
You can find me in my art over at sisterhighdesign.com. I have cure prints coming. A lot of people have messaged me about being able to buy those cure prints. They are happening. They are being shipped to me. As soon as I have them in hand, they will go up on my site. And even before that, there will be a lot of notice about pre-orders and orders on that. So it is happening. They are coming. You will be able to get them and you will not miss out. I promise. You can also follow me on social media. I am on Instagram and Questnot. If you look for Sister Hyde or flip it around at Hyde Sister, that's what my ats are. And if you follow me on Letterboxd, you can just search for Sister Hyde or Drusilla Adeline. I'm over there. You can see all of the great spooky, spooky stuff I watched in October. Some really, really dope shit. What about you, Josh? Where can people insta-stalk you?
On Instagram or Blue Sky at Joshua Conkle or Letterboxd, where I'm going right now to raise my rating for Army of Darkness. Next week.
I love to bully people.
Yeah, I definitely feel bullied. next week, we are coming back to the contemporary kind of era. And what are we watching?
We are watching a movie that Josh is bringing to us from the contemporary world of all the way back in 2016.
Yeah, a different decade. not this one.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. You're right. Yeah. From director Liam Gavin, we will be venturing into a darker song.
A dark song.
A dark song.
Can't wait. It'll be interesting.
The sequel is a darker song, a darker, I'm sure.
More songing. See you next week. Bye-bye.